Welcome to Maxed Out Man, helping you become the man you were made to be.
Hey guys, it's Kevin Davis from the Maxed Out Man podcast. This is episode number 57. I'm here with Dr. Jason Frischman. Jason is a psychologist and is the founder and lead guide of Journeyman. Journey Men, which inspires committed, well-balanced men to successfully journey through life with responsibility, meaning, and intention. Jason's also a husband and father of two boys. I have two girls, so that'll be an interesting discussion. He's a men's coach and psychologist, an adventurer and creative cook, and an everyday lover of stories. For over 25 years, his mission has been to help boys, men, and families live connected and adventurous lives every day. Our lives are made up of so many stories, and he helps men to both write and live their preferred stories and helps fathers struggling to balance work, family, and family to become more confident, connected, and fully alive. I love every bit of that. So I'm pretty excited to have you on. This is right up my alley as far as, you know, information that I love to gather and people I love to talk to. So I appreciate you coming on board.
Absolutely. No, it was great when we first met and sort of chatted initially. And, you know, I'm reading that bio and I'm like, oh man, I should get a little more concise. But yeah, all of those things are a lot of fun to hear. I'll tell you that.
Well, you know, and it's funny because I'm sure that doesn't even scratch the surface. So, you know, fill us in on like your history, how you got here, what you do now, kind of what your passions are along the way. We have as long as you want to take, so don't feel like you need to be that concise. I love hearing the different stories because that adds the foundation for where our discussion goes.
Absolutely. No, that would be great. So, you know, how I got here, it's interesting because friends of mine, I'm fortunate enough to have friends from childhood that I'm still very close with, and they'll laugh because they're like, you are doing exactly what we, you know, figured you might be doing with a few shifts. Right. Like, so, you know, I have, I'm living in Vermont. I came from New York originally. I was in the suburbs of New York City. And from about 13, I used to say, I'm going to live in Vermont. Like, I knew that. I went to a summer camp here as a kid and was in love, right? Really, like, I love this area. I love the winter. You know, really, I knew that so much so that is almost, I could say that's how I met my wife, right? I went to, long story, but I went to a conference specifically for a particular workshop. I met the workshop presenters. It was a couple and they were inviting me. They were like, oh, well, you should move out to Oregon to work with us. And I was like, well, no, my heart's in Vermont. I'm going to move there after I graduate. And they said, oh, are you single? Our niece lives in Vermont. At which point this couple refused to talk to me about anything other than will I meet their niece? And, you know, as 8 months later, we were living together. So
that's awesome. You know, yeah, that's great.
Yeah, it's a wonderful part of the story. And I've always wanted to be in Vermont. And it was circuitous. I went to undergrad up in northwestern New York in Buffalo. I went to graduate school in Georgia and then Boston. I worked in New Hampshire for a long, you know, so I was all over the place. And my first grad program made the most sense in terms of people who know me was for something called adventure therapy. So I have a degree in something called adventure therapy, which is a very little known, you know, practice, although it's international and it's gotten pretty big. But that was, for me, I love the outdoors. I love adventuring in general as a concept. That's been a massive part of my life, as has always been stories and books. So adventures and stories is the foundation of who I am and all of the work I do, right? I like to joke that many professions, you know, a carpenter has their tools, the hammer, the you know, all the different professions have tools. In my profession, I'm the tool. You
know, like my wife says in our marriage, I'm the tool. So I don't know if that's the same thing.
I mean, sometimes it feels like it. Yes. but that's really important because who I am has a huge part of the type of work I do and how I choose to work, do the work I do. And so, you know, My master's was a real focus on adventure therapy. My doctorate, I focused on something called narrative therapy. So now I'm a licensed adventure storyteller or storytelling adventurer, however you'd want to be. And yet the interesting thing was in 1999, I hiked the Appalachian Trail, or most of it. And about three quarters of the way through, I had this epiphany on a mountain that I needed to go do more traditional based therapy just to compare, just to see what that's like. Came off the mountain like that day, called my parents, who said, "Oh, well, you were just offered a job in Boston." I was like, okay. So after living in the woods for 5.5 months, 3 days later, I'm in Dorchester, Massachusetts, living there and working in the school systems. And my big question always was, when I am doing offering therapy services in a school where my therapy office is literally a bathroom with a desk over it, over the toilet,
Oh my gosh.
or a locker room or the space under a stairwell or whatnot, how can I do adventure therapy? Because that's really what I believe in. That's how I sharpen my tool. And the answer really was metaphor. Right? What is the metaphor? What is the narrative, the stories of adventures and journeys that I can bring into the office with me? And so that started, all the way up, and then, eventually moving to Vermont. And I have a psychotherapy practice here where, again, I'm in an office, right? And, friends of mine from the adventure therapy world are like, "How do you deal with that? You're not in the woods, you're not." And I said, "Well, I still go for myself. But therapy is an adventure in and of itself. Every hour, on the hour, all day, I get to go somewhere different with a client." Right? And then developing the stories and the narratives of these adventure and journey metaphors and using them as a way of engaging with men and boys and families and helping them to live their own adventures and to really become the heroes and main characters in their own stories. So that's really the main over, the overall piece of what I do. But the recently last 4 or 5 years, I've been doing coaching specifically for dads using a model I've created around what I call foundational adventures and basically how dads can be connected at home much more sort of sustainably and powerfully with the people they purport to love the most. That's
Yeah,
a
I want to dig
whirlwind of
into that.
everything.
Oh, I love it. I want to dig into, can you kind of describe the difference between what you were doing before with adventure therapy? I'm out here in Montana, so adventure therapy sounds awesome.
Nice.
And we'll talk offline about some other ideas I have, but can you kind of contrast what, and just give me more, give us more information about what you're talking about in terms of like, I'm in an office, I could still be on an adventure with each session and all that. Can you kind of give me a little bit more info on that?
Absolutely. This took a lot of thinking about what is an adventure and what is a journey and how are they related and different, and all of these things. And very sort of in a oversimplified way, an adventure is something where there is some level of perceived or real risk. You don't know what the ending is going to be like. You have some supportive characters, some main characters, there's a goal, things like that. And so for many years, it was okay, well, there is the adventure of life. There is adventure of the seasons and the years. There's anything that's cyclical has adventure baked into it. And stories, we're always taught stories have a beginning, middle, and end. And frankly, I think that's, such a constructed way of looking at it because frankly, unless everyone is born at the beginning of your story and everyone dies at the end of the story, there's a backstory and there's a next story. So all stories are just the middle. Okay. And so if I can look at our session as an adventure in and of itself, how can I structure what we're going to talk about, how we're going to do things, what we're going to explore, right, within that hour? And we can construct a beginning, middle, and an end for our little middle. And the challenges, right? The risk, the challenges, the things that the characters need to go through are, meaning the client and I, are the issues we're working on, right? They're the things that want the obstacles that are in the way for the clients I work with. And so another element of adventure is there's an activity, right? So we don't always do that in my office. You know, I'm certainly like my office, even though I think I do things very differently, we're still often sitting in chairs, looking and talking to one another. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, there's an activity in the mind. There is certainly, I have done activities with clients. I can tell you about the time I taught a client how to debone a chicken during a session, and we were able to use that as a metaphor for the issues that he's working on. That's a whole other story. But small.
I want to hear that story after you finish this one for sure, because I think that's super cool.
Yeah, you know, small activities within, you know, for an hour session or for longer now that I'm doing some coaching work. But it's this idea of how can we take the concepts, the overall pieces of what is involved in adventure, and bring it into our everyday moments. And, you know, that's then developed even further, because now I question a lot of what we think of as an adventure. What's an adventure? And I don't know if you've heard of, and or your listeners, but the, you know, the concept of the hero's journey. Mm-hmm. That's okay. So yep. Hero's journey, for anyone who may not know, is very simple, right? There's a hero, main character, who either gets kicked out or called out of their home place to go on some sort of quest. They go into a different area, a different realm, a different whatever. They have all sorts of challenges. They climb the mountain, they battle a dragon, you know, all of those things. And they find the treasure, the magic object, whatever it is. And then they do everything backwards to get home, where they're either, you know, so celebrated or pushed out because they don't even recognize them because all the changes that happen in there. I love that story, right? I'm a big Star Wars dork. I love Lord of the Rings. Like, you know, I like that story, but someone who thinks probably more deeply than most about the idea of adventures and journeys, I really had to start questioning that, right? Why is a part of narrative therapy is questioning taken for granted stories in our lives, right? When I ask people about the hero's journey, they go, oh yeah, of course, right? And so even though I love it, I wrote my dissertation using that as the main metaphor, right? Even though I love it, I had to question this. Why is this the only story? You know, for years, I would ask people at workshops and clients, I'd say, what's your favorite adventure story, live or fictional or real? And I always got the same answer, some version of the hero's journey. And for a long time, I just pat myself in the back. I was like, good, I'm on the right track. And that's awesome. And then I started really doing a lot of research into men and men's development and men in our culture and the history of masculinity, and came to something that, you know, frankly, it was very strange to do, knowing how much I love this narrative. But I actually think that the fact that this hero's journey is so everywhere, it's omnipresent. It's, you know, every Pixar movie, the vast majority of Disney movies, you know, almost every hero blockbuster movie that's out, it's all the same narrative. So much that the person who coined that term, they called it the monomyth, said it is the one story. But he was wrong. And, you know, there are other stories in the history of our, you know, folk oral traditions that are not that narrative. And I've come to really believe that the fact that the hero's journey is so much everywhere in our culture is actually quite damaging to boys and men specifically. And subsequently, right, damaged boys and men become damaging boys and men. Right. And so this becomes a big underlying piece of the work I do, which is not throwing away the hero's journey, because I still love it, but opening up other elements, other stories, other teaching models, other ways of looking at how to be, that can really help men and boys have a whole expression of who they are as humans, as people, right? And so I don't know what got me on that, but that's, you know, so this idea of questioning the hero's journey, holding on to it. My original company was called Adventure's Other Half. Right. It's what else is there besides this one story that is guiding so much of what's going on in our culture? You know, the hero's journey, although it is lovely and it has wonderful elements of growth and development and all those things, it also pretty much talks about might makes right. History is written by the victor. You know, there is no grays, it's black and white thinking. There's only good and evil. There's, you know, there's some real challenges. And even if the main character happens to be a woman, you know, there's a lot of that, you know, there's a lot of diversity being put into this narrative. It's still a very masculine energy in the idea of I go off and I do things and I fix things and I, you know, and there's nothing wrong with that inherently, but it's not the only way to be. And if it's the only story we get, you know, go ahead. Sorry.
I was just asking if you could dig into that a little bit more and I just want to understand what you mean by that's a damaging, because I can see how, you know, good guys always win and we beat people up. And I mean, all those movies that I love, right? Like one of my favorite movies is if stuff blows up, people get beaten up and there's irreverent humor. Like those are, you could give me any movie and I will watch it, whether it's the worst movie ever made or not, you know? But I'm interested in knowing kind of how that damage manifests itself. I mean, like, you're right. That is the story. And we weave that story throughout stuff. We're doing a marriage workshop this week, marriage, man, and mission. And one of the things we talk about in terms of marriage is being the hero in her story, right? Ooh. Like as a husband, I want to be the hero in her story. And that can mean, you know, again, and we're not saying that means you ride a white horse and, you know, beat up your neighbors and all that kind of stuff. But it's that concept of being a hero. Cause I think most men in general want to be a hero. But I'd just like to know kind of what you mean by that mentality or that manifestation can be damaging, especially to boys. And I do want to dig into boys as well. Yeah. So,
oh, absolutely. I mean, here's the thing, right? Like, of course, I want to be the hero for my wife. I also want her to be the hero for me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so this idea of it is that, you know, again, black and white thinking, good looking people, you know, like there is the values are often very interesting. But there's also inherent in the hero's journey narrative is a dominance based sort of ideology. I'm going to conquer.
Okay.
I'm going to go off and beat the dragon. I'm going to, you know, and even though they've been shifted a little bit, maybe they befriend the dragon or whatever, but there's this like, we're going to manifest destiny. We're going to go off and conquer. Right. And there's, you know, there's been a lot of research and work done that, like, while sometimes that's necessary, of course, it's actually a dominance based cultural organization has really led to a lot of, in-group, out-group work, you know, where we're better than them. We other people. The majority is just better than the minority in many ways. Like, right. If we can dominate, we're better. We're clearly more powerful. We're, you know, we deserve more, you know, there's so much to that. So that's one thing. The other piece I think is there's a term called man box culture. Is that something you've come across?
I haven't. Man box. I'd love to hear about it though.
So man box culture was coined years ago. I'm not going to get the whole history. I used to know this, but basically man box culture was basically a term coined for sort of mainstream masculine culture where, you know, you've got to be tough. You've got to be strong. You've got to be pretty much in charge of your emotions. And that's actually speaking generously, right? Like, mm-hmm. or don't have them at all, right? Push them away. And, you know, there is a certain sort of character that men, quote, need to fit into. And especially boys. And if they don't, there actually are sort of social ramifications. You know, the way I talk about it is as a culture, and this is not every individual, you may be different, individuals may be different, but as a culture, you know, the way I talk about it is, you know, as young as 2 and 3 years old, we systemically and systematically bully boys into the men's box. There's a woman who did this, a wonderful researcher named Niobe Way, who researched boys and boys' friendships. And for the most part, you know, one story that always breaks my heart was she's interviewed this young kid, I forget how young, 4 or 5, who said, yeah, no, I'm friends with the girls, but don't tell anybody because then the boys won't let me play with them. Right. And we have this thing where teenagers who have earlier had really great close male friends start to drift apart, right? They push it away because another element of the man box is anything that seem as feminine or homosexual or whatever is seen as less than, right? And I mean, if we think about what are the most common slurs teenage boys call one another, and they are mostly all some version of a put down that is feminized, right? Feminized or homosexual, right? Like that. Right. Those are the insults that teen boys tell one another, which is an interesting message to like share about all of the other humans that we come into contact with, right? And so this idea that, you know, the hero's journey reinforces that ever so slightly, right? Like, I love it. I watch those movies, right? Like, I sometimes on my own, my wife goes to bed, I'm going to watch a movie. I want explosions, good looking people, you know, like I'm there. And at the same time, you know, what it does, it also elevates this going off to adventure, right? The men that I see in my office, right? If I'm not epic, if I'm not legendary, then what am I? Because the other piece of the hero's journey is we don't really hear much about the people who go to work every day and are tending the fields or keeping the hearth burning or wiping the butts and cleaning the toilets. And, you know, in fact, all of that is seen as less than, you know, you're either a prince, a hero, a king, or a peasant, right? And most of the peasant work is stuff that we see as women's work, which is denigrated and put down, right? And so this idea that, you know, men who, you know, get up, go to work, even like a lot of my clients do really well at work. They're incredibly successful. They're powerful, right? They're going off on their hero's journey. But then, and I don't use this as marketing, and this is sort of very tongue in cheek, but I often joke that my favorite or perfect clients all have hemorrhoids because they come home and they hide in the bathroom, right? and like, they're not as connected to the home life for many reasons that we're not even aware of, for many reasons that are sort of implicit, that we're not like being sort of overtly talking about with our partners or being aware of, and it's often not specific to the chore, right? I have a friend of mine who heard me talk about this once and was like, well, I clean and do most of the cooking and I do like this. And I'm like, yeah, you're right. But how much of the conversation between you and your partner are you having around, like, you know, this happened when we were over there for dinner and, you know, he was saying like, I do a lot of the home stuff. I was like, great. Did you know we were coming over tonight? Did you have to like rearrange your schedule? You know, we got there and he was still at work, right? Did you rearrange things to be present for us? The social things. Do you know your kid's doctor's first name? Right? Like so it's not specific to women's work, men's work. It's more specific to how do we create partnerships with our partners and with the people. As a, you know, there's a woman named Rianne Eisler who is a real hero to me. And she put forth this whole idea of dominance-based cultures as opposed to partnership-based cultures. And partnership-based cultures existed. They, you know, we are often told the story that like hero's journey ideas are just human nature, right? It's just human nature that men are strong and provide and, you know, all of this. But frankly, it's not, it's not a capital T truth. It's not a truth. It's a story that we have been shared and talked about for hundreds of years that we can challenge and we can have, you know, if we look at what's going on in the world today, right? We have domination. We have, you know, all sorts of oppression, all sorts of, you know, from global to national to family. Right? How do we talk to our kids? How do we, you know, men who, frankly, you know, they can feel mad, bad, or angry, you know, like, and I'm exaggerating a little bit, but
yeah.
Right? Yeah. So, there's a lot to it. And it isn't about weakening men or saying like, we have to be, you know, soft or whatever, but we also can be soft. We also, you know, the way the metaphor I love to use, the one that I share a lot is if you, you know, there's a lot of, before I get to the metaphor, there's a lot of talk about the mental health crisis, right? Men, mm-hmm. you know, men have the highest rates of suicide. They're dying from heart attacks earlier. They're, you know, depression, anxiety, you know, like I have no problem filling my therapy practice, you know?
Yeah.
Boys with depression and anger, you know, school shootings, you know, violence, all of these things, there's a mental health crisis, right? Well, now to the metaphor. If we took a plant and put it in a room with no windows, no sunlight, and didn't water it, and then the plant died and we said, oh my goodness, there's a plant health crisis, right? We've got to create a fertilizer, chemical fertilizer that we can sell that will help these plants do better in this dark, waterless room, mm-hmm. right? That's similar to what we're doing here. Yes, there is a mental health crisis, but it's a symptom of the fact that we're not giving boys and men what they need, which is emotional awareness, connections, loving relationships, you know, the other half of the hero's journey. And so as a result, I see men all the time in both my coaching practice and my therapy practice who are really hurting, right? They don't even know what's going on with them inside because they haven't identified the feelings, right? I will say one quick story and then I'll be quiet for a minute. You know, I get excited about this stuff, but.
No, you're good. You're good. You're good.
I have, journeyman, started year, you know, the ideas really came about before the pandemic when I was working in person in my office. And I'm sitting with a client who for about 20 minutes was telling me how good of a weekend he had with his buddies, doing all of the things we probably all could imagine he was doing with his buddies over the weekend on a camping trip. And I don't judge that. I do that. I think it's lovely. But then he got quiet and said, yeah, you know, all that was great. But if my wife left me, I would have nobody to tell.
Wow. Yeah.
And the hard part was on the other side of my door in my waiting room was a guy who I knew he was there because I'd been seeing him for years and he's always early. So I knew he was sitting there. And if I literally was allowed to open the door and introduce these guys, they both would have had less need of me. And they would have had a real true social connection if they were open to it, right? That
right.
would be healing and curative and supportive in a way that a lot of men don't have, right? And so to me, it was both heartbreaking and motivating to really say, all right, well, how can I do this differently? How can I support men in a way that can be really and truly powerful? And that's where, you know, in many ways, that's skipping ahead, that's where Journeyman kind of was born. And the idea of saying, well, we can do both, right? We can mm-hmm. have these big, wonderful adventures and be strong and be, you know, all of those things. You know, I was up last night chopping wood, right? Like I'm manly, right? But at the same time, you know, I taught my boys how to fish when they were very young. Like, you know, we do that. But at the same time, you know, I tell them I love them every night. You know, we do lots of cuddles. I'm the main cook. You know, and I'm still not always getting it right. My wife will remind me, right? Like, so, you know, this idea that we can be more, right? And we can deepen our stories to really thrive. And it makes life more meaningful. It makes life, you know, when we're more aligned with the things we give a shit about. Can I swear? Is that all right?
Oh, yeah.
You know, okay. So when we're really aligned with what we give a shit about, then even the everyday things, the everyday adventures, the mundane elements of life can be meaningful. They can be like supportive and nourishing, and we can feel better. Like, you know, it's really quite a powerful but simple idea is that having everyday things like cleaning the toilet, like chopping wood, like cleaning the dishes, like, you know, all of these things, like connecting with your partner around, you know, schedules and calendars and doctor, you know, all of these things, if we're really having a true partnership, then it strengthens and builds and allows us it, almost that, you know, if we do the foundational journeys, then we're better when we do have a hero's journey, I'm better with the sword. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm better with a more, you know, when I, my foundation and my grounding are strong, I'm going to do better when I leave the house and the community. I'm going to be more connected. I'm going to be doing better at my job. I'm going to, you know, all of those things, because I know I don't have to hide in the bathroom when I come home.
Yeah, for sure. I'm interested in one of the things that you were talking about with this particular client, where he's discussing this camping trip, sitting around the campfire and all that. And it, do you, how do you teach men how to have better connections? I feel like it's fear based. And it's a misunderstanding that other guys may want to do this. You know, I had one of my guests, the title of the episode was, "Hey, I Love You, Man." And it's a lot, it's that concept that, you know, with my friends, and I don't have a lot of friends and I don't have a lot of local friends. Most of my friends, you know, we spend most time on FaceTime or text or whatever, because they're all over the world. But we do talk about real serious stuff. You know, hey, how's your marriage? How's, you know, I know last year you were going through this with your wife. How are things going now? What does that look like? What did you change? What did she change? And all of that. So we talk about those deep things. But I feel like that, you know, to your point about this kind of masculine, you know, this man box ideology, there's maybe six guys sitting around the campfire and they're all be like, you know, every single one of them has something that they're facing and dealing with. And every single one of them is too afraid to say, hey,
yeah.
Anybody else feel like their wife emasculates you, or you feel like you're not living up to her expectations, or, you know, you're struggling to be a dad, or any of those, you know, all those things that we deal with? What does that look like? How do you bridge? How do you get the courage to start that conversation? And really it's this, you know, high school microcosm, right? Like you talked about teen boys. And I've told people all the time, it's like this microcosm that exists in junior high and high school is complete BS, because it doesn't exist for the most part. This is something that's manufactured, but then I think it can continue into these male relationships, I think, are just predominantly like that, to where, look, if I try to share, I'm going to get made fun of, or whatever, which they're all thinking that, and it's all BS. If one person Absolutely. Would just speak up, if one dude would just speak up, then everybody opens up. So how do men bridge that gap and actually take that first step?
That's the question. I mean, you know, I think you and I could talk for hours on that question and probably not come up with the best answer, because it is a real challenge. You know, I joke about it. You know, I'm a guy who's been doing this kind of work for a long time. My dearest, oldest friend, someone who I've known since we were 12, we've been close, if not best friends, almost that whole time. And he's a very sort of aware, conscientious, you know, he was a teacher. He's like a very, you know, he's a very emotionally expressive kind of guy. It took us until our 30s until we could say, I love you. And even then it was, I love you, man. I love you, man. And then it evolved into, I love your brother. And then it involved, you know, we're, you know, I'm almost 50.
I have a buddy of mine that's a little bit older than me and is really uncomfortable with, I love you, man. And so what I will say to him is, I love you, but like not in a weird way.
Right. Well, but and because that helps him
feel better, right?
Absolutely. I mean, that's exactly it. Women throw around, I love you, to like someone they met at the store that day, right? Like, you know, and men, I mean, think about this. We have in our culture, we have an entire genre of movies just to make fun of this. We have bromances, right? We can't, you know, we so rarely have movies when men have deep emotional, real friendships without it being a comedy. Like we have to make fun of it in order, like, you know, but not in a weird way, right? You know, the term, I think, I don't know if the kids are still using it these days, but the whole term, no homo.
Mm.
Right?
Yeah.
That was a term. I don't know if it's still being used, but it was, you know, I love you, no homo. You know, those are cool shoes, no homo. Right? Like,
yeah, all right.
We have to do that. And yet it is so, I mean, so I was going to say, this friend of mine, you know, I'm almost 50. And only in the very recent times have, like, when we don't live nearby, you know, so when we see each other and then we're saying goodbye, like, give each other a hug and really just say, like, I love you. I hope you do well. Like, yep. You know, blah, blah, blah. Like,
yep.
And so you're absolutely right. There's fear involved. I think there's fear. There's also an implicit unawareness, right? Like, we're not even, like, fully there. And, you know, but you're absolutely right. I mean, I'll tell you, in the therapy practice where I do this, it's a lot easier because often things are just breaking. Right. Like my wife is leaving me. My kids won't talk to me. I'm getting fired from a job. I have an addiction. You know, things are breaking. So they come in and we get to work, you know. But similar to the plant I mentioned earlier, I think men, like plants, we need certain things. Water, less sunlight, emotional connection, expression, awareness, to be seen and heard, you know, all of these things. And so once we open the door a crack, most men that I work with, and I've been doing this for about 20 years, run through. And so you're actually right. So in the therapy world, you know, I haven't had to market. I still turn away more people, more men a week than I can take. In the coaching world, it's a bigger challenge, right? Because it's not as much about things are broken. It's more about, oh, I want things to be better. And men notoriously are difficult to engage in wellness, fathers even more so, because I work with fathers. And the interesting thing, though, is that the guys who go through the program fucking love it. Like, they like the moment we get started, you can see that they're like, oh, I can do this here. And they, you know, we have a text thread. So that in between coaching sessions, they can, you know, I've been privy to text messages that are more emotionally vulnerable than most men have in their conversations every day. Right. And
right.
So, you know, how do we create it? I think part of it is it's a challenge. And so we accept that, you know, that's part of the work that I'm doing, right? Is to help. Like, to me, there's part of a social action in this, is that let's change the narrative of men, masculinity, and fatherhood so that this is okay. So the guys that I'm working with now, they're the pioneers for this. They're willing to take the risk, right? Because there is a fear. So there is a risk. It's an adventure, right? Like, are they willing to take the adventure to slow down and learn and be and do this kind of thing? The other piece is that I've turned a lot of the metaphors of this work on their head, upside down. So a vast majority of men's programs, men's coaching, you know, men's therapy, they actually use the hero's journey metaphor as well. You know, a lot of them do, and it's lovely. I feel like, you know, like I told you, the hero's journey is only half the story. I need to help men find the other half, the foundational half. And so I didn't want my coaching program to look like, again, we're just using the hero's journey. And so in a lot of coaching programs, men, they get together, they go off together to do something. They have a pretty similar goal. They get the treasure and then they go home and they're better for their families or their work or their executive work. Or, you know, I come from the place where, you know, I talk to these dads and I say, listen, outside of coaching is your adventure. Your adventure is at home. Your adventure is at work. Your adventure is with your kids. So what are we going to do? And I think back, my favorite aspects of all of the great stories that I've loved as a kid, you know, Star Wars, Lord of the Rings, these kinds of things. I always loved the inns, the scenes at the inns or the taverns, the cantinas, like the meat, you know, even as a kid, I, you know, sword fighting and all that was cool. I was a martial artist for a long time, but like, I loved when people got together and, like, you know, had these meeting places, right? So why do you go to a tavern, right? Besides food and drink, you go for nourishment, right? You go to tell and hear stories. You go to rest. You go to fix your equipment or get new equipment. You go to celebrate a win or lick your wounds from a loss. You go to find a new quest. You go to get information from the shady guy in the corner, right? Like, that's what happens. And so the entire overriding metaphor for journeymen is I get to be the host of a virtual inn where men can come in from their adventures and drop their shoulders and get taken care of and have a space where they can share stories and be like, oh man, you got to hear this. Or they can get some, like, hey, try this. here's something you can try. Let's sharpen your steel. Let's, you know, whatever. And then they go back out for their, you know, and join their adventures. And then they have a space they can always come to. Right. So every Tuesday, any of the guys that have ever gone through the program, there's just I call it open gatherings at the inn. You know, like we, you know, if you've gone through the program, you can come and either share a dad joke or get some support for something that's blowing up at home, or, you know, just, you know, or we have conversations around masculinity. And, you know, there, it's just sort of it's a free for all that anyone who's ever gone through the program has access to. Right. So this doesn't answer your question, right? How do you break the seal?
Yeah.
I think there's many ways. One is questioning it. So I do a lot of things where I do talks, I do a lot of presentations, I'll do things on social media. So there's me doing that. There's increasingly allowing people to be more aware of the fact that there is a seal, like what would happen if. And there's just talking about it. I mean, I try to get on as many podcasts as possible. My friends and family know that this is my, you know, sort of one of the three things that I talk about the most. And it's around raising awareness and social activism around this idea that, frankly, I think it's life or death. Like, we have men who are dying because they can't talk about things, you know, high blood pressure, heart attacks, you know, suicide, you know, and so even the men who are not at that extreme level, we all benefit. We all benefit from having loving, connected, you know, emotional connections with the people we care about. So I tell that over and over again, try to get as many guys around the fire as you can, you know?
Well, and I love that because those conversations need to happen. On this podcast, we've really had a ton of conversations. One of the guests that I've had is, he's got a podcast called The Evolved Caveman, when we talked about, you know, the feminine energy and John.
And, yeah, he's great.
John's awesome. And, you know, he's been doing stuff with his new girl also, which has been awesome to see. But a lot of the podcasts, and this has been something that's really opened my eyes, is really to talk through, because I kind of naturally do this. My wife and I have a relationship that tends to be traditional in some ways, but untraditional in other ways. You know, she's a total badass welder, rally car driver, of these different quote unquote masculine stuff. And I've been involved in that side of the coin a lot. But at the same time, like, she hates doing the bathrooms. And so when we split up house duties when we clean our house every couple of weeks, I do all the bathrooms in the house. It's just my, mm-hmm. you know, so that, and, you know, so it's a little bit less traditional in how that works. I really like your tavern kind of that conversational thing. And I was thinking that one of the things that I tend, and part of that irreverent comedy part of a lot of those movies that I like is because, and I never really thought about this before, but it's kind of because there's a vulnerability in a lot of those kind of things, mm-hmm. where a lot of times it's a character connection through this irreverent comedy with each other. And it doesn't, you know, you could take that as far as you want, but that's something. And one of the other things I really like, there's a movie with Channing Tatum, you know, no Oscar winning there, but Channing, I like his movies. That is called Dog.
Okay,
so the movie is about him. So the movie is about one of the soldiers had died in his unit, Army guy, I think. Can't remember if it's Marines or Army, so forgive me if I mess that up. But he has to take the dog, which was a working military dog that this guy was the handler.
He has to take him
to the funeral. So it's a great, I mean, I love the movie. I like dog movies, I think, because and I'm a dog guy. I'm not a cat guy, which means both my daughters have multiple cats, of course. But I'm a dog person. Like I just love dogs. But it's that kind of man dog connection that has a no BS kind of underlayment is something that I really like. My family makes fun of me because I will literally cry at any dog movie. Like, it's going to happen.
Awesome.
But it's, and I, you know, as I examine that, and again, I don't want to get too woo woo about it, but it's like, I can see that the unabashed love that a dog has for their human and that connection is something that I like and I just connect with.
Yeah, I love that. And that's, you know, I think you're absolutely right. There is, you know, especially I find as we get older, you know, fathers, mm-hmm. I'll say especially just because I connect, like all of a sudden, yeah, they're like crying at dog movies or, you know, like this and it emerges because, again, it's stuff we need. We need that as much as we need, you know, eating, breathing, you know, all these kinds of things. So you're absolutely right. And I love the idea that the irreverent humor is also creates a connection because, you know, and you said we can go as deep as we want. That is, that's exactly, I go deep on that concept. That's a really powerful thing for me. There are, in the men's world work, in the men's movement, these kind of things, there's a lot of talk about archetypes, right? Mm-hmm. And the sort of, you know, for one, a lot of people who use archetypes may or may not have studied them. And so we just put labels on and we use them, we attach to them. And it's a very interesting, you know, concept, the archetypes. But, you know, if I said king, warrior, magician, lover, you either have heard of them or you can resonate with them. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That as a archetype for men was constructed. It was created. It's not a given. This is not like we're born with 10 fingers and men should become warriors and kings, right? Like that is a story that has been created. And in fact, it was created in the 80s by a guy who wrote a book about men's work. And it was powerful. It was an amazing, I love it. You know, I think for the time it was what we needed. But even in that book, he says, there are other archetypes for men, but those are for soft men, and we don't need that right now. Right? Mm. And so as a result, we have, you know, all of these men's work and coaches who talk about be the warrior, be the king, be the, you know, and some of that is really important. I don't denigrate it or put it down at all. But what it's doing is it's almost like, again, if you're only focused on one part of a story or one part of right? If I gave you a cheeseburger and left out the meat, you'd be like, well, this isn't a cheeseburger. It might be tasty, but it's not what I want, right? There are other archetypes that also describe mature masculinity. And what's really powerful, my favorite of them, is the archetype of the trickster. So it goes back to irreverent humor, right? The trickster and the trickster in many different cultures and all of these things is often seen as a representation of mature masculinity because it's in very different context than the hero. The hero, black and white, might makes right, all of these things. The trickster, because in our culture, we look at everything through the hero's journey lens, the trickster can only be at best an anti-hero, but is usually seen as a villain, right? Like Loki or, you know, all these things. But the reality is that the way tricksters are seen outside the lens of the hero's journey is they screw shit up, but they take responsibility for it. They make intentional choices. They speak truth to power like jesters would. Like they can say the truth in a way that power can hear it. They also stand up to power. They will say this is wrong and not worry about getting killed like a prince might or, you know, like a hero, right? The trickster uses humor to engage and make fun of, you know, powerful structures in culture that are not being questioned. Right. There's all sorts of history in different cultures and different times where tricksters were the shaman. They were the people who were able to sort of question all of the rituals because like, hey, don't take this shit too seriously. Come on. This is something we're doing to make ourselves feel better. But let's be honest, you know, like the ability to be a trickster is the ability to be able to make mistakes and be human, but also take responsibility. And understand, like, my favorite example, just because I happen to like Norse mythology and the MCU, is Loki. It's my favorite example. And in one of the Norse myths of Loki, he caused the end of the world, right? He caused, you know, Ragnarok. He caused the whole destruction of their plane. But right before that, he did something to get one of the other gods sent to the underworld. Mm. Right. And everyone was like, oh my God, you framed this god, you did this terrible thing, and then he created the end of the world, and the gods put him in jail. And he said, yeah, okay, take me. That's cool. The end of the world happens, but the god who was down in the underworld was able to come back and restore everything.
Yeah.
And the things that were going on before the end of the world were able to be mitigated and challenged. Now, that is obviously a ridiculously oversimplified version of the story, but it makes the point, right? Like,
right.
Our irreverent humor. I mean, think about when things were going on in the beginning of the pandemic and everyone's scared. And then we had January 6th. And then we had, all of the different things. Who became some of the most popular celebrities? The comedians, right? Trevor yeah. Noah, all of the late night pundits who were comedians, like late night shows, they were giving news to people, which is his own thing, whatever, but they were able to speak to things that, someone else who's in the game, just on the other side, isn't able to speak to in the same way, right? So yeah. The tricksters have a voice that we aren't able to do. And so actually, to answer your last question, I also try to use humor. I try to, engage guys in a way, right now I'm doing this thing even on social media where every day I post a dad joke, right? Dad jokes are a thing. And I probably have thought more deeply about dad jokes than should be, but dad jokes are a thing. I think because they are a remnant, they're leftover from this trickster archetype. And what are they? They're play on words. Words create reality. They tell stories. And so when we mess with words and we get the groans, it's that other side of irreverence, right? Like we can have, we can have irreverent humor, but we also can have like sort of the best irreverent humor is a little bit smart too, right?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's interesting because I would probably tend. Oh, there you go. I love that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I lean towards the trickster ideology a little bit. That archetype is kind of me. I've told people if I'm quiet and not like giving you a hard time or really engaging with you, and I use humor a lot. A lot of times, overly, because I'll tell my wife after we have people over for dinner, I'll ask her. I'm like, that felt like I was a lot. Was I a lot? And she's like, yeah, you're a little over the top. Cause I can be a lot. I've got a really outgoing personality, even though I'm an introvert, but I use humor as a way to connect with people. So I really like that. I mean, even, and I can see that these comedians that are out there that are somewhat pointed, you take someone like Dave Chappelle, who a lot of people find extremely and offensive. But at the same time, he's using humor to say, look, you guys are making all of this stuff so serious and such a thing that I'm going to make fun of it in a way that's going to make you all super uncomfortable, right? Like he's got some stuff at his latest special that is like, oh my gosh, I can't believe that he just said that. But you step back and say, look, it's not a big a deal as we all want to make it. Right. Like life is not as big. Life doesn't have to be as difficult and as hard and as serious as the media would tell us it needs to be, the anxiety ridden, fear ridden information that we get, that Absolutely. Kind of thing. I want to be respectful of your time, but I'm really interested in one particular aspect of this and a question because I think that you have such a diverse way of thinking about this because you've been comparing and contrasting all along the way. But one of the things I've talked a lot about on this podcast and in my coaching and in my discussions is this idea that men, masculine, quote unquote, traditional masculine men, which I tend to fall into that. Like I'm a car guy. I'm not a hunter, but I'm a car guy. I work out. I'm fit, all of these things. So I fit that upper middle class white guy, right? Like I tend to be the societal enemy. how are we balancing? Cause I feel like a little bit what's going on now in our culture is that we are, we've got crazy kind of this gender ideology and all this weird stuff that, right or wrong, whether you agree with it or not, it is kind of weird what we're dealing with right now in society. How are we teaching boys and just men in general this whole idea that men do, you know, we're filled with testosterone. We have, most of us are strong. Most of us have natural tendencies towards certain activities. Most of the time, we're mostly the firemen and police and military and all of those things. So how do you balance this in teaching boys how to be, okay, it's okay if you do lean towards the masculine. Like, it's okay if you don't lean towards the masculine, but it's also okay if you do, because I feel like some of the cultural stuff that we're seeing right now is telling us that it's not okay to be masculine. Absolutely. Right? Like that, oh, you know, yeah. We have those words like toxic masculinity and all of that kind of stuff. And so I think you're a great person to ask this question. Like, how do we navigate that right now?
You know, it's a great question, and it's really challenging, right? You know, I'll start just by saying, like, you know, I don't like the concept of toxic masculinity, right? Like, there are toxic behaviors, right?
I literally have a sign on my wall that says, masculinity is not toxic. Some men just suck.
Right.
I mean, it's an oversimplification of it, but it's like, it's not masculinity that's the problem. It's the individual that's the problem. Exactly.
Well, typically. And I would add, not just the individual, I would add, there's a social pressure. There's, like, back to the man box.
Correct.
Right. The man box culture is toxic. It's toxic. Yeah. You know, I don't like it, but the truth is patriarchy doesn't like men either. And so this is really powerful. You know, the truth is the patriarchy is something that, you know, if I am forced to be within the man box or essentially bullied or punished for not being that way, then I'm kept in fear. Then I'm not able to have full expression of my own self. Then I'm not, you know, and I might become, quote, powerful, where I can dominate others, which makes me money, which makes me this, which are all lovely. You know, I would like to make money, right? That's nothing wrong with that. But there's something wrong with it when we do it by oppressing and putting down others. And I use oppression in a very intentional way, not just in the systemic, you know, racial or otherwise, but even in a smaller, you know, day-to-day, how we deal with other people, bullying or whatnot. So yeah, I think it's really important to think about this question, because masculinity in and of itself, yes, it is not toxic. At the same time, and this is we can go into this even in another conversation, because I'd like us to stay in touch. But anyway.
Yeah, for sure, 100%.
You know, but a lot of the things that we think of as typically traditionally masculine are not biological. They are not neurological. They are socially constructed. Now, does that mean that it's wrong to do them? No, of course not, right? Because something socially constructed does not mean it's inherently wrong, right? Like, I'm not into cars. I'm not really that into sports, but I was a martial artist. I fish. I chop wood. There are certain things that I do that are definitely within the masculine way of being. And so I think for helping kids and men, boys and men, is just about saying there's more. I mean, yeah. You know, like, it's a really wonderful thing if we think about it that way, right? Let's not constrict and restrict ourselves. Let's have more possibilities, right? Like,
yeah.
I love the fact that, you know, when our last house, we live in the country here in Vermont, but we used to live in the city of Burlington, and we shared a duplex, and the other side of the house was some of our best friends. And the wife of that family is a carpenter, but she's more than that. She's a contractor. She has gotten awards. She's amazing. And I loved the fact that when something broke, when my kids were very little, they went to her. But if they were hungry, they went to me. I'm the cook. But if they needed, if they needed the, like, support in sort of like just being heard and seen, they went to my wife. right? Like they were different roles. And then we played around with them, right? Because I would be like, I can fix stuff, you know, and I would learn or, you know, and then, you know, but this idea that we can be more. I think that's the piece that's really important. I actually, on top of working with men and fathers, like I'm currently right now running a group of sort of late tween, early teen boys around this work, around puberty, around sex, around gender, about all of these things. And a lot of it was, you know, one of the kids raised his hand in our last session and basically said, so you, it's okay to be kind of anything. I was like, what do we think about that? Right. Like how cool is that? Right. Like, you know, you can go off and watch football all day. And then if you want later on, I don't know, whatever, bake crumpets, I don't know, whatever it's going to be. Right. You know,
right.
And how cool is the idea that as humans, not as men or as women, we have an infinite a way of self-expression. Right. And
right.
You know, to your point around like things are going on around gender and identity, you know, it's strange. Like you said, it's weird and strange, mostly because it's new to us. And it's new to us because it hasn't, frankly, I think because it's been pushed away and seen as different and so wrong, which brings us back to our hero's journey ideology, right? Like we push it away. It's existed in cultures for thousands of years. We've known about it. It's just not been accepted, right? One of the kids of our group last week, we went through a lot of different terms and, you know, just because I want these kids to be aware of what's around. And one kid raised his hand and said, so if we lived in a culture where no one really cared, I had them play with terms for sex and whatnot. One of the ones they liked was bumping uglies. So, you know, this 14 year old said, so if we were in a culture where nobody cared who you liked or who you wanted to bump uglies with, would we need all of these terms? And I was like, that's a great, you know, great thought. Like, I don't know. We might still need some terms because you'd have to communicate what you wanted to do and with whom, right? So you'd still need something.
Yeah.
But they would not have the same judgment or value or difference. Like, we wouldn't have to be like, oh, you know, someone, one of the kids said, well, you know, no one runs around saying I am heterosexual. And I was like, well, because you don't need to. Everyone assumes you are unless you say otherwise. Let's be aware of these things. So for me, it's a long way of answering a question, but I think it's allowing for difference, encouraging awareness and being able to say like expression can be, you can be masculine and you can do all these other things. You can, you know, allow that, but also to be accepting and to understand that, like, we don't have to, you know, force people to be in the man box in order to be a man.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Instead of being, or, you know, I'm a man or I'm not, it's more of an and, right? Like I'm a man, yet I can serve my wife in a way that supports her emotionally. I can serve her in a way that's more traditional. I can, you know, I can do these things that are not necessarily, they're definitely not in the man box. Like I will sew my own clothes. If I end up, I don't make my own clothes, but like, if I need to quote unquote darn a sock or all that stuff, like that's, I do that. That's, you know, that's my thing. But
exactly.
So I definitely appreciate that. And I think, you know, I think we could have a whole, you know, much, we could do Joe Rogan level podcast length on this one. But I think that's a great place to kind of land the plane, as Mike Rowe says. I really appreciate your insight and what you're doing. And I'm excited to continue to connect. And I'm excited what you're doing to help men be, like we say in Max Out Man, you know, be who they were made to be who they were meant to be. So.
Absolutely. I love that. Yeah. I mean, I appreciate the ability or the willingness to really go here. And I think this conversation, I'd love to continue. And, you know, I'm looking to get to know you more. It'll be fun.
Yeah. So how do we find out more information about what you got going on?
So the best way I think would probably be, you know, my website is journeymenfoundation.com. I would say at this point, you know, the I sometimes slip and say we, but really Journeyman is me. So my email is, you know, jason@nourishedconnections.com. And if anyone emails me, you'll get a response from me. Yeah. And then the one thing that I can offer also, like I put it together a while ago, but I was just reading it and it still holds, is it's a PDF that I've shared of the 10 ways that dads can most effectively and efficiently connect with their kids. And I do all of them myself. I've shared them with clients for years. And I timed myself. I used a stopwatch. If you do all 10 of them, it's less than 15 minutes every day.
Nice.
You know,
yeah, I and love so that. That's a great resource.
I'll share that link. And, you know, I think that it's been really powerful. You know, I'll give you a quick example is every single night of my kids' lives. And remember, I have two boys. every single night, without fail. So even if, let's say, I go away for a few nights, I'll either call or if I'm camping, leave an individual note for every night I'm gone. Or if they go away, same thing. I'll either put, you know, they go camping, I'll put it in their sleeping bags. But every single night, I say to them the same 12 words, and I have not missed since they were kids. I'm sure my 15-year-old at some point there'll be a change, but still now I say, I love you for always and forever. You're my sweet one.
Oh, nice. And I love that.
I say that and I give them a kiss. They say it back to me and they give me a kiss. And the statement's not important, but the repetition, the foundation, my 15-year-old can go at it and totally be angry with each other. And I have to be the adult when they go to bed and be like, I'm going to say it. I'm going to. So I go in and I say it and he looks at me and I said, you don't have to. And sometimes and as I walk out of the room, I hear him mumbling it. I love you forever. You know, and it's so important. It's like takes 12 seconds.
Yeah.
And over the course of time, what it does is say, even if we're arguing, you know, no matter how big of an argument it is, I'm committed to knowing and loving you for life.
Love that.
And that's powerful. 12 seconds.
I love it. Yeah. I love it for sure. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate you and we'll stay in touch for sure.
Absolutely. I'm looking forward to it. And let's keep in touch. Thank you.
If you're looking to really maximize your life and become the man you were made to be, head over to maxedoutman.com and get your journey started today.